Welcome to the Black Sparrow Media Internet Broadcast Network.
This is episode number 138 of Linux in the Ham Shack, the very first episode of 2015.
Woo! Yay. Woohoo! Welcome to 2015.
Yes, and Dave got there before the rest of us.
Yeah.
2 hours before. Yeah.
So, he's in the future.
We're going to do a kind of a special episode of Linux in the Ham Shack. We're not going to follow our usual format. We're going to have just the interview with David Rowe, who is Victor Kilo 5, Delta Romeo Golf. Or no, Delta Golf Romeo. Delta Golf Romeo.
That's right. Yep.
I'm gonna call this Studio 3D, and the 3D is the three dogs who are kind of making a nightmare for everybody right now. Come on, get down. No. All right. Anyway, so back in July of 2012, we talked with David Rowe once before, and that was about the Codec 2 project, which has come a long way, I'm guessing, in 2.5 years.
Wow, so, that long ago, was it?
Yeah, it was.
I was going to say, I don't remember that interview, but that was before my time.
So I figured we would kind of revisit Codec 2, and particularly as it relates to FreeDV, because it's a topic that has come up recently on our program, because I have just started playing with FreeDV.
Oh, good. Yeah.
So we want to find out everything that's happened in the last 2.5 years with Codec 2, and what's going on in the world of digital HF, and so on and so forth. But maybe you can talk a little bit about yourself first, not that you haven't been doing that for the last 10 minutes for those people who probably weren't here and won't hear that part of it. But you are from Adelaide in South Australia.
Yeah, I live in suburban Adelaide, which is a city of about 1 million people, sort of in the middle of Australia on the bottom.
In the middle on the bottom.
Yeah, southern edge. Oh, so I guess it's on the south coast in the middle. Yeah.
Right. And for us, it's 8:30 in the evening, and for you, it's about 1 in the afternoon. So that's...
That's right. A hot summer's day.
Yeah. All right. You have one of those half-hour time zones. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, it's a bit odd. It's because of the daylight savings and things like that across the country. The states can't agree, so they put a half hour in there.
All right.
They do the same thing here in Newfoundland. It's half an hour off, so we have one province like that too.
Yeah, well, Canada's just weird anyway.
Oh,
I agree.
All right, so Dave, what do you do like as a job when you're not fumbling about with ham radio and such?
Yeah, well, actually, this is pretty much what I do these days. I have sort of had a career in satellite communications and work at university doing R&D into speech compression. But these days, I'm kind of, I guess, semi-retired. And when I am working, it's on open source digital voice stuff. In particular, the FreeDV type technology for the last couple of years.
Oh, that's nice.
I do have a web store that sells a few products that I've developed through previous projects and things. But no, mainly these days it's full time on this sort of technology.
Well, that's good. It sounds like you're doing what you love, which is a sure sign of success.
Yeah, well, I really enjoy it. I see a need for it, and I have a chance to use these skills that I've developed to help people out. So, I get a lot out of it.
All right. So
I saw that on your website where you say you're trying to make the world a better place, and I thought that was quite admirable.
Yeah, just a little bit better. That's enough.
just a little bit. We don't want too much.
Yeah, and there is kind of a selfie edge to that. Like, I just didn't find I was getting enough out of just working for money and doing the corporate thing and all the things that I'm meant to be doing.
Oops, probably sorry, King tonight.
That's another guy kind of caught me. I'll just reject that for now. That was a guy called Rick Barnich, a US ham, who's helping me build the SM1000. What a great lead-in. Rick is a recently retired electronic engineer, active ham in the States, and he approached me about a year ago and wanted to work with me on the SM1000, which is basically an embedded version of FreeDV. So no PCs or laptops required. It's just a little box that sits on your desk, or can even hold it in your hand, use it like a handheld microphone. But inside it is a powerful microcontroller, and that runs the whole FreeDV stack. So you've got your speech codec, the modem, and a bit of control software to tie it all together. So this thing plugs into your radio, either a HF or even a VHF radio, into the mic and speaker jacks, and turns it into a digital voice radio. And we're in the late stages of developing that. I've just got the first beta units just before Christmas. So Rick and I are tidying up the last few details before we do our first production run in about a month or so.
It's pretty small, and, too. I see it's only 80 by 100 millimeters. Is that correct?
Like, yeah. That's tiny. Yeah, that's right. It is quite tiny. It's smaller than an iPhone sort of length and width.
It's probably enough to put like the audio jacks, and then the rest of it's probably microscopic.
Yeah, well, one of the big problems that Rick struggled with was getting enough room for all the jacks, because we've got things like got an RJ45 that can plug it straight into a lot of, say, the Yaesu gear. We've also got 3.5mm jacks for those who want to, you know, sort of patch it into their radio in a different way. And, getting board perimeter just to get all the jacks was the major problem.
It's good that it's that small, because most hams shacks, as you know, are already cluttered, so there's no room for a big piece of gear. You want little things. Yeah,
it's funny. It's smaller than a HT or something like that.
And really affordable, too. I see your price point is under $200 US, which is
amazing. Yeah. We're hoping to sell them for $200. And the idea behind this is to about a year ago, I looked around at what we'd done for DV. Both myself and a bunch of other guys have been helping out with it. And we decided one thing we need to do was make it really easy for people to use. At the moment, you need a laptop, you know, a couple of sound cards. There's quite a bit of fiddling to set it up. It's okay once you've got it going, but this will make it a little bit more plug and play. And it removes you from the PC, so you can use the thing mobile if you want to, even plug it into a HT or something like that, and get digital voice over one of them.
One nice thing was
a VHF mode to support that later this year.
When I was setting it up originally, one of the nice ways to avoid the sort of double sound card issue is to use a USB audio device like a headset.
Yes, yeah. Yes, that's an excellent way. Yep, use a USB headset as one of your audio devices.
Yeah, definitely remove some of the complexity in the configuration and actually. It got me on the air very quickly. As I was saying on a previous episode, it took me 30 minutes to get on the air with FreeDB, and that included a round trip to Walmart to buy the headset.
Oh, that's nice. Great. Well done. Yeah.
So, all right. So before we jump into FreeDB.
We'll continue to maintain the PC version of FreeDB. This is just pretty much the same code running in a neat little embedded platform.
All right. Well, that's cool. Now, I wanted to jump back a little bit and talk about Codec 2, which sort of underpins FreeDV. So if you could maybe go through the genesis of the Codec 2 project and where you're at now.
Sure. The Codec 2 started as my PhD, the output of my PhD, which I did in the 1990s. And that was in low bitrate speech coding. And that sat on the university shelf for 10 years till Bruce Perens and Jean-Marc Vallin contacted me about 5 years ago. And said, hey, you know, the open source world needs a low bitrate codec. What could you do? And I eventually got motivated and got working on it. Dusted off the code, some of it stretching back into the 80s. Turned the thing into a usable, functional speech codec, which was great for me. Everyone likes to, when you do a doctorate, it's really nice to be able to use that stuff for something in the real world.
Yeah.
And it's been useful for a lot of people, mainly in the key niche for it seems to be HF digital voice. And of course, hams are a big user of that. There's also a lot of other people who are interested in HF digital voice, like, you know, humanitarian applications, military. And there was nothing in the sub 5,000 kilobits per second that was open source. So this fills that niche. And it's been progressing gradually downwards from there. We've got modes down to, the latest experimental one is 450 bits per second. And the one that people use for most of the FreeDV work is 1,300 bits per second.
450 bits per second, and that produces intelligible audio?
Yeah, there's some samples up on my website from a post a few months back. What I was playing with there is how bad can I make it sound but still make it intelligible? Because I finally realized that's what single sideband is like in limiting conditions, you know, when you're using phonetics and talking very slowly and repeating yourself. One of the second goals that I'm working on at the moment is to make FreeDV work better than single sideband. So I started by taking a look at SSB and where it wins, where it loses, and why it does work so well on HF channels. And one of the things I worked out was it's actually really bad in bad channels, but it gets the message through. So I sort of thought, well, okay, rather than treating digital voice as something that's got to be perfect all the time or not there, can we make the digital voice quality drop but still get that message through on a really bad channel? And that's where the I went crazy for about 2 hours on the keyboard and came up with the 450 bits per second mode as a first pass. But we'll hopefully improve a lower bitrate version through the year, improve the quality a bit, and make it even more robust.
So in a signal on HF for Codec 2 in its normal configuration, about how much spectrum will that use, you know, for the 1300?
Okay, so we take the 1300 bits per second codec, add a little bit of FEC, and then and put it through the modem, and I think it's around 1200 hertz of analog bandwidth or RF bandwidth. So about half a single sideband channel at the moment for the current 3DV mode that you can access with the x86 3DV software.
Okay, that's pretty exciting because I've used 3DV a little bit and I've actually had a conversation on 3DV and it really sounds almost like single sideband when you're having that conversation, except there is no noise to speak of because.
Because
which is really nice. So there was one question that came up in the previous episode. It was asked by a listener, and I produced my own off the top of my head answer to the question. But I'm really interested in hearing the real answer to the question. And the question was, why is FreeDV in the voice part of the band? And I had, what I thought was a reasonable explanation as to why it's there. So let's hear it from you.
Oh, I don't know. So your explanation is probably better than mine. That question usually sets off about 3 days of arguments on the mailing list, and I sort of stand back and go back to my coding.
Do you have a preference as to why it is, or do you have an inkling or why you think it's there?
The argument seems to be that it's fundamentally its voice. At the end of the day, it's phone, so it sits in the phone segment.
Do you think it could be used equally well in the data portion? I mean, do you think it would pass muster with various, regulation entities as that it's data if it were in that part of the band?
The issue seems to be the bandwidth it still uses is a bit wider than something, like PSK31. So say the code or data section of the bands is pretty narrow and that would chew up quite a lot of it. I don't actually have a position, I should point out. They're just the arguments that I see when all hell breaks loose on the mailing list when this question is asked.
Well, so your answer was actually different than mine. You seem to think it's because it's in a wider part of the band where voice generally is, and that's why it's been accepted there. I noticed that I can't remember what the site is, but it's sort of like a DX cluster, but for FreeDV, like a FreeDV cluster.
Yes. Yeah, the QSO finder, yes.
Right. And the calling frequencies are all in, of course, the voice portion of the band. So.
Yeah. there's some other sort of mixed systems in that area too, like the SSTV tends to be around that frequency as well. And it's an interesting... at the moment there's some coexistence between the two modes and the design of FreeDV, it's been encouraged that we make it narrowband because it tends to put a punchier signal that stops people intentionally or unintentionally interfering with it, with SSB. And it is fairly robust to SSB interference.
So so Codec 2 predates FreeDV. Was Codec 2 like... Did FreeDV come about because of Codec 2? It's like, wow, this is how we can use this?
Yeah, that's right. So, I saw this need. I was told about this need by Bruce Perens and a few other people for people like Mel Witten for an open source codec. It was really missing from the digital voice architecture, one of the key things that was missing. But then I finished it and I said, okay, who's going to turn it into, put it on the air into a real thing? Who's got a modem? And no one had a modem. And one of my previous lives, I was... involved in building modems for satellite communications, so I know how to build them. So I thought, okay, well, I'll build a modem. And that was about the time I met you, I think, in the middle of 2012. Then the next step was we needed an application to tie the modem and the codec together, put a GUI on it, draw waterfall diagrams. And once again, I asked around who would do that, and a guy by the name of Dave Witten stepped up and started working on it. And he came up with quite a nice design for things like sound drivers and the GUI toolkits. We insisted that it be cross-platform and open source. A previous incarnation, FDM DV1, wasn't, and when there were issues with the code and the people working on it. It suddenly just evaporated from the ham scene, which was very unfortunate. So we made this one personality independent by making it open source from the very start. And Dave and I worked on that towards the end of 2012 and released FreeDV about 2 years ago now in its initial incarnation. And then I think I did a bit of work about 6 months after that to make it a bit more robust. And then from then on, it's been little tweaks. But the big thing we need to do now is improve the quality on poor SSB channels. Also looking at developing a VHF mode. Been doing some work on modems for VHF recently. And also get the SM1000 running everything.
Speaking of VHF, we actually had a question about VHF and using FreeDV on VHF. Do you see a use case for that or...?
Yeah, well, what's happened is we initially focused on HF because that's where the hole was in the digital voice architecture. There's several competing DV systems in VHF, and it seemed fairly well established. But a lot of people aren't too happy with that. They don't like the idea of spending big money on a new rig that only runs one company's digital voice system, and they're closed, essentially. The codec's closed. There's limits to the experimentation you can do. And what I found was people are actually running FreeDV over FM, would you believe? So it's this... The modem waveform is this multi-tone phase shift keyed waveform, and they're actually then putting that over FM, and it works okay. So people are playing with it, and I thought, well, let's look into what we can do if we can do this properly. And over the last few months, I've been developing some simulations of modems and the VHF channel and just seeing what can be done. And I believe with the right sort of modem and codec too that we can get a significant quality improvement over existing FM and DV modes, like as much as, or power and quality, as much as 10 dB improvement. So what we're doing at the moment with 5 watts, we'll be able to do with 500 milliwatts on VHF with this system. That sounds too good to be true, so I'm in the process of developing some more software so we can test it over the air, and a couple of other hams are working with me on that.
So is this all using the SM1000 for doing that?
I start off using a signal processing language called Octave, which is a sort of just a programming language that's really good for doing things like modems and codecs. And it just all runs in simulation form on my PC. And then out of that comes wave files, and these wave files will be the modem tones. And I just play them through an existing radio over the air, so either an SSB or FM radio, record it, and then put it back through the simulations again. That's how everything starts. Once I'm happy with the simulations, they're all running sort of offline. I then code it up in C, and then it's ready to be integrated into the PC version of FreeDV or into the SM1000. They just cross-compile between them.
Interesting way of doing things. I'm not sure we even talked about how you did the actual development of the codec and stuff, in the original conversation.
Yes. Yep, start off with some sort of simulation form and then into C for real-time work.
I know in our first discussion, we kind of got really down into the nitty-gritty of how you actually get the compression that you get in the waveform and all of that, and I don't know that we need to get into the science of it again. You said that, was it David Whitten or Whitman who did the GUI?
David Whitten, yeah. He was the co-author of the PC version of FreeDV during the period of 2012-2013.
And did you have a hand in that as well, or as far as...
Yeah, both. Dave started it, and then I chipped in and helped him with the integration and some of the signal processing side. And currently, though, Dave's no longer working on the project, and I'm really busy doing other things. So if any of your listeners can do a little bit of C coding and are interested in helping out, we'd really appreciate some help on the C coding side for things like FreeDV. You don't have to have a PhD in signal processing. A lot of it's just regular C code. And it's great stuff and for a good cause. You know, we're really pushing the art of HF digital voice forward.
Yeah, I wish I knew C better, but I haven't done any C since the late 80s. So I think
some of this code was written then.
I'm afraid I'd be about that rusty, though, if I tried to get into it, but it is interesting. One thing I was curious about, in the application for the PC, in the waterfall, when you're not receiving a FreeDV signal, the waveform looks one way, and then when you actually are receiving a signal, it basically completely changes, and it shows you the FreeDV waveform, or something that looks like a signal in the waterfall, which seems to be a little different than the way other applications work. Usually, like if you're looking at a PSK in a waterfall, you you see the spectrum, and then each signal shows as a line, basically, in the spectrum. Whereas in FreeDV, you basically get nothing until you get something. Is that just the way it is? Because it was a little weird for me, because I was wondering why I wasn't, you know, seeing anything. And there isn't any way to sort of, like, scan the band, you know what I'm saying, for a FreeDV signal. It's you're either there.
Yeah, well, the FreeDV signal takes up at least half of your SSB bandwidth, whereas you can see, you know, 10 or 20 PSK31 signals in the same bandwidth. If you had an SDR with a wide bandwidth, like the Flex guys, for example, then they could see several parallel FreeDV signals at the same time. So that's kind of a function of the current bandwidth of ham radio receivers, or HF radios in general, I guess. They're usually set to that 3 kilohertz bandwidth, and usually that's only enough room for one or two FreeDV signals. The other reason is I didn't really know what waterfalls were meant to look like, so I was kind of winging it when I wrote that.
No, it was just a little odd, because it's not something I had seen before in practice, and it's just kind of like, you know, before, you know, if you have a wide enough view into the spectrum, you can see, like you said, multiple like PSK signals inside there. And I understand that one FreeDV signal is about half of what you can actually see in your waterfall. But it's just like, you know, you can't just like go up and down through the band looking for something that looks like FreeDV, or at least it didn't look that way to me. It's just you kind of went to the calling frequency, and if somebody was calling, then all of a sudden it was there and you heard a voice. You know.
That's right. Yeah, there's not too much other activity up and down the band, and no real way to tune that easily at the moment, at least. No, probably possible to interface the tuning on the FreeDV program to the radio, though, to scan up and down. Someone would like to have a go at that.
Well, something to consider for the future, I guess. Now, the FreeDV program interfaces with the Linux Hamlib, I assume, for rig control and stuff like that?
Yeah, it's got several rig interfaces. Hamlib, sort of a direct serial connection, if you want to just tie your PTT to, you know, a DTS or DTR line. And one other method, which I forget at the moment, but there's three different ways of doing PTT control. The SM1000 is quite neat. You just press the push-to-talk button on the side of the SM1000 and the rig keys. It connects directly to the PTT line.
Like, would the other thing have been like RigCat or something like that, maybe?
I can't recall now. Oh, Vox.
Vox, okay, yeah. Okay, so yeah, the SM1000 sounds like a great little interface. I might have to take a look at that. Of course, I've already got a setup that's working, but for doing something considerably more compact, it sounds like a wonderful little device. Do you have any thoughts on when that will actually go into production? I know you're kind of sort of halfway between here and there right now.
Yeah, no, I'm hoping to. Basically, we're about to push the button, just doing the final rev on the PCB and the box that Rick designed. So within a month or two, they'll be on sale. Well, I think we're running into Chinese New Year at the moment. So if we don't get it in the next 3 or 4 days, we have to wait 3 or 4 weeks. But anyway, it's close.
Will you be selling those off of your site, or will they be available sort of widely, or what?
Yeah, good question. What I'd like to do, I guess, is some sort of way to distribute them in the US. Also, they'll be for sale through our Chinese manufacturer's website. I think he's got a worldwide shipping thing that's quite reasonable. And I'll have some stock here in Australia as well. But happy to try and look into distribution of that sort of thing.
All right, that sounds good.
Who does the manufacturing? Are you allowed to say, or is it like a...
Yeah, sure. Secret? Yeah, no, it's a friend of mine, Edwin Chen at Dragino, dragino.com in Shenzhen, China. Been working with Edwin for 5 or 6 years, and previously on some voiceover IP products, some other open hardware products that I developed. The SM1000 is open hardware, by the way. All the CAD information is in SVN and circuit diagrams, so we encourage people to get in there and fool around with it and change and modify it if they want to.
So you're going to sell it as a kit or just a unit?
No, fully assembled, ready to go. What I found is that despite things being open hardware, people want a product, not a project. It'll be fully assembled, ready to go, you basically need a little bit of time to plug it into your rig and configure and set a few levels with a little trimmer, trim pots, and away you go.
Oh, that sounds really good. And, of course, the whole thing is self-contained, so it's sort of platform agnostic as far as
Yes, and we've got things like there's a little patch panel on it there to adjust the pinout of things for your particular radio. Also very low power, so great for soda work. I think 200 milliwatts or something. So, yeah, you could run it on a couple of a tiny little battery pack all day, certainly longer than your radio battery pack will last.
Oh, very cool.
And it's fully programmable. You can reflash it from any PC. So, and open source, all the software's open. So if people come up with a, you know, improved user interface or they want to change the modem or the forward error correction, go for it, you know. And people can experiment with it to their heart's content.
So let's talk a little bit about operation in FreeDV. How much of that do you do, and where have you like who's around on FreeDV? I noticed that on the tracker or the DX cluster or whatever you want to call it, uptake doesn't seem to be real big right now.
Yeah, it sort of comes and goes. But I think what we're waiting for is when we start to get the performance up around you know, the single sideband level. Currently, when it works really well, noise-free communications, but suffers a bit from HF fading and things like that. Having said that, there is a pretty active community, in particular over there on the East Coast in the US. And there's guys, one guy showed me his logbook the other day. He's had 500 contacts on FreeDV, all states, plus into Europe. Bit of communication between Europe and the US. I don't use it too much myself. I tend to code away and do simulations and things. There's a community of a couple of dozen guys local to me who work on it and help me with testing and things as well. When I need to do some local communications. But yeah, it's fair to say it hasn't had a huge uptake yet, but we'll keep working away, and we're getting a lot of good feedback. We have a really good team in place there, a lot of guys helping us with testing and things like that. Lately, what I did was, as I mentioned, I developed some new waveforms and through the simulation, and I just publish them on the internet, and then I get people to transmit them for me around the world and send me results. So I work with other people like that, but not too much on the air myself, unfortunately.
Well, that's okay. You're too busy making it better for the rest of us, which is a noble endeavor.
Thank you.
So I have a question from our chat room. Ted Williams, W-A-0-E-I-R, who is also a ham radio coder. He's written TWPSK, TWCW, and
great
other applications. He wants to know, or he's speculating about the waterfall issue that I mentioned, and he asked, could you add something equivalent to a PL to the FreeDV signal to ID in the waterfall?
It's actually pretty easy to spot. Once you've seen one, you'll know what they look like. You have the two central PSK pilots at a high level, plus the tones either side. So spotting it is pretty easy. I think it might just be the lack of activity and bandwidth of your receiver, so you don't see similar to PSK31.
Yeah, my situation was pretty deaf where I was. I didn't have a lot of luck on any mode, really, including FreeDV. But when the stuff came in, it was there. I mean, it's kind of like an FM signal on VHF. It's like when it's there, you know.
Yes, it's a lot like that. Mm.
It was definitely a change for me to hear something that sounded so crystal clear and noise free on an HF band.
Yeah, a lot of people think they're using FM or something like that. It's quite remarkable.
Yeah, if you haven't used it before and you're tuning around on your HF rig and all of a sudden you hear a FreeDV signal, just all of a sudden crystal clear voice coming through, it's a little strange for sure.
Yeah, and it's really easy if people just want to listen in. You just need a PC with a sound card, and you can run the FreeDV program in receive only, so it's quite easy to listen around.
Yep, and if you use that locator, you can find out exactly where to tune to, you know, what frequency to hit, where most people will be likely to be active, and there's usually someone there just calling CQ or chatting or whatever, and I noticed that even when I couldn't talk to anyone, that I could certainly hear the conversation, so it was very nice that way.
Yeah, we've even picked up a bit of that activity here.
All right, well, while I think of something else, Pete, you got anything else? Should I talk about bushfires some more, or?
No, we've not done that. No, I was actually roaming around your website a little bit before the show, and I'm fascinated with your blog. First of all, the blog post, I mean, there's so many people following you on the blog. I don't know how long it's been that you've been doing the blog, but I was quite taken with the fact that you, there's a line I saw somewhere that you like to talk about what went wrong and how to fix it, how you like to teach your readers something new in every blog post, and that there's a lot of activity in there, and there's a lot of really interesting information. So I'm assuming this just came about with your philosophy of you wanting to share what you've learned and what you're developing, and probably also, I don't know, could you tell us a little bit about that? Probably also a little bit of a log of your life's work at the same time, I'm guessing.
Yeah, well, I think the blog started in 2006 when I sort of quit the last day job that I had. And I like writing, and I'm okay at it. And I sort of decided to settle on this narrative style. So I write about my projects as they happen, and, you know, warts and all. Real life, we make mistakes, we screw up, we go back and fix them, and go down a few blind alleys. And I like to talk about that sort of thing rather than just the, you know, it was all perfect to start with and I got it going really easily, because it just doesn't work that way. And often if I get stuck on something, I figure, well, maybe someone else might get stuck on that, so I'll write about it. And fortunately, I like writing and I've got a fair bit of time to do that sort of thing. So it sort of evolved that way. And, yeah, it gets more and more popular. I think it's something like 150,000 unique IPs a month now.
Oh, wow.
What's that, 5,000 a day. And the top 10 list sort of shows me what people are interested in. Sometimes annoying, because some of the stuff I don't like, they do. keeps coming up pop as the most popular, which I didn't think was anything very special. And some of the ones I like aren't there, or the ones I like the best. But, yeah, it seems to help people. And getting I get a reference a fair bit from Wikipedia too, because I've explained things in a way that is easy for people to follow.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
No, there was one particular one that I came across that where you're talking about. I love Krispy Kreme donuts. There's one just around the corner.
Yeah.
Talking about your son being excited that they're opening a Krispy Kreme factory.
Yeah,
in
our first Krispy Kreme recently. Yeah.
And then you go on to discuss how you know, the equivalent, or you use the donut to explain energy, which I thought was just, you know, phenomenal.
Yeah, the energy production of the Krispy Kreme, I think it was equivalent to three wind turbines or something like that. Enough fat to add 1 kilogram to every person in the city each year.
Yeah, and it probably will, because they're quite yummy.
Yeah, I know, that was a phenomenon. The city went crazy. Yeah, there's another one along that vein, so the fuel consumption of a pedestrian crossing, you know, how many gallons of fuel you use when you press stop to cross the road, and things like that.
Mm. No, I bookmarked it, and I'm planning on going back and checking it out regularly. So I also noticed you're a user of an electric car that you
– Yeah.
You used the commercial car and you converted it yourself. Is that correct?
Yeah,
you made your own electric car, basically?
That's right, yeah. There's quite a few people doing this around the world. You take an old petrol car that's at the end of its life and replace the motor with an electric motor and some batteries. And it's recently sort of got a lot more viable with the release of lithium batteries about 4 or 5 years ago. So, yeah, since then I've sold my internal combustion engine car and all I've got is the electric car now. And that's fine for a commuter around town. So, yeah, I've been driving that. That was on the road about 5 years ago now. So all electric for 5 years and really enjoying it. I don't miss that. Occasionally I borrow a petrol car if I've got to go a long way, or hire one, or catch a train or something like that.
Is it easy in Adelaide to find a place to plug in? I know Montreal's getting to be a little bit more user-friendly for electric cars. You see a lot more of them. And, you know, the local – you know, the bigger malls will have spots where you can plug in and stuff like that. So
there's a few places, but to be honest, I just don't think it's necessary. Adelaide's, you know, a city of 1 million people. It's kind of hard to drive more than 40 minutes in any direction. So I just plug it in at night when I get home, just, you know, a bit like charging my smartphone. In fact, it lasts a bit longer than my smartphone normally. You know, that's so this whole thing about charge points, it just hasn't been a practical problem for me, living in a city where I do. And I think as the EVs evolve, this range anxiety thing's going to go away. You know, we'll have 200 or 300 kilometre EVs for $15,000, you know, in 5 years' time, and it'll all go away. And when you do run short, you know, if you're at your friend's place, you just plug in.
I think it's – I think there would have been a lot more development in that market if it wasn't for the petrol companies, you know, crushing the initiative, as it were. So I think that's what's limiting a lot of the production right now.
Yeah, well, once you've had an electric car, it's kind of hard to go back. Some things you take for granted in a petrol car, like I sit there at the lights and wonder why all these engines are idling around me. You know, why would you do that?
Right.
You look
They're
at
so complex. Quiet.
Yeah.
Every once in a while, I almost get hit by one. I mean, I live in the city, so sometimes I just cross the road and I'm just used to listening for cars. You can't do that anymore.
They're quiet. I'm the same on my bike. I use my ears, my eyes to see if there's a car coming.
Yeah, that's what I do now. I've gotten into the habit of doing that now, but it's pretty amazing how quiet they are, which is great. Mm-hmm. I mean, if one day we eliminate petrol cars, and just think of the people living by freeways, they'll just be loving it, be loving life.
Yeah, well, at low speed they're pretty quiet, but the road noise tends to dominate. You know, above maybe 30 miles an hour, they sound like a regular car. But in a car park or something, yeah, that can be pretty deadly.
Yeah. So how long have you been licensed? I'm heading back into the ham radio realm now. You've been licensed for quite a while, I'm assuming.
1981, I got my novice license when I was at high school. Yeah. Started off with a converted CB, whatever the top level was in Australia. So they've changed all the licenses around here. I forget what I am now, but I think I'm at the whatever the top level is.
Okay.
I'm allowed to put anything on the air I want. That's the important thing.
Yeah, there you go.
So when you're experimenting with new modes of voice, that's kind of important.
Yeah, you'd converted a CB into up into the lower ham bands.
Yeah. There was a guy who used to do that back then. This was in the early 80s, and $30, he'd cut a few tracks on the phase lock loop and retune the PA, and you'd have an SSB rig on 10 meters, and that was right. The height of one of the solar cycles. So I'd come home from high school and work, 30 JAs after school, and graduated to a regular HF rig.
How did you discover ham radio? How did you get into the whole geeky electronics kind of world?
I was a geeky kid before it was fashionable, and in the 70s.
Oh, so you got beat up a lot, just like me.
Yeah. Well, according to my mother, I was crawling towards the PowerPoints when I was a baby, and she was what was wrong with me. and it developed from there. And ham radio was what you got into in the 70s and early 80s, because they weren't PCs. This was just when the early Z80 model, Apple Model 1s were coming out, before PCs of any description. And so that's what you got into. But I got into computers when they came out too. I was doing assembler, Z80 assembler, and when I was 14 or 15 or something as well. And initial playing with sampling signals through the cassette port and decoding weather signals and stuff like that, early modems and things. Yeah, so that was a kind of cool time to be a kid, just when computers were coming in, as well as having ham radio around. Yeah.
Oh, very cool. Russ, you seemed to wanted to break in there.
Oh, no. I was enjoying the conversation about the electric cars. I was wondering if it was a Holden.
it's a Daihatsu. Right.
Yeah, there's a picture of it on the website. I was actually shocked when I saw it. I was expecting this nice new space age thing, it's like, wow.
No, it's a 1991 car. I'm quite proud because of the embodied energy.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's recycling it to the max for sure.
I just got it back too because my daughter just left home and got her own place, and she sort of took over when she was living with me, and I didn't get to see my car for about 2 years. But now I got it back because she loved it. It's basically no maintenance, no petrol costs. It's just a few cents a day to run it.
Right. Yeah, no, it's amazing. Yeah.
All right. Well, I think I ran out of my questions dealing with Kodak 2 and FreeEV and where it is now. But if there's something else we forgot to mention, or if you want to mention some of the developers or anything else you want to talk about the either of those projects, you could stick it in here.
There is one thing I'm working on at the moment that, given the theme of your show is Linux and ham stuff, we're off to linuxconf.au in about a week, which is one of the three big Linux conferences in the world. It's in Auckland, New Zealand this year. And we've got a mini conference on basically building a little SDR receiver. So most of these guys are Linux guys, but we're hoping to get them interested in things radio. So we've developed a little software.
Yeah. Uh-oh.
I think he's coming back.
Oh, there.
Linux and SDR in general, and it can be built in a few hours. So I've designed it specifically to be built in a few hours.
We lost you there for a few seconds, like for maybe 10 seconds, Dave. I don't know if you were still talking.
Yes, I was just talking about this open radio that we're working on, openradio.net.au, and it's basically a little kit club project SDR that can be built in a few hours and can run on Linux. Right. And specifically, joining those two worlds of Linux and radio together.
Are you going to be actually building one at LinuxConf, or?
We're building 30. We've got a whole day.
Wow.
Two places left for the workshop. And they've been kitted up, so where you can buy extras. And so if, you know, clubs who are interested in either, you know, Linux guys interested in radio guys interested in Linux, or I think it'll even run Windows SDR software. It's fairly generic. Then you can buy these things and do it as a club project. They're about $60 each, the kits.
Well, that sounds good. And if there are a couple of spots left, I know we have several Kiwi and Aussie listeners. So if they hear this and they're interested in that, which sounds great, I would love to go down there. But the airfare to Australia and New Zealand from here is a bit pricey.
Yeah, so we're quite excited about that and a lot of fun. We put a lot of work into making it easy to assemble. It's got, you know, you have to wind a coil, but just one. You know, you have to solder a few surface mount components, but we've made them big. You know, the biggest parts we could, just to give people a real taste of the whole assembly thing.
Well, that sounds great. LinuxConf AU is something I hope to get to one of these days. Are you going to be at Hamvention this year? Or
haven't made any plans this year. Still a bit early in the year. So I did go a few years ago, had a great time there. And we usually have some sort of free DV presence. You mentioned the price of the tickets between here. That's sort of my issue too, in the reverse. It's probably a good $5,000 by the time I've, you know, got the tickets and accommodation and things like that for me. And as I do this as a volunteer, you know, that's a fair bit of money on top of everything else. And the time factor, you know, when you take into account, you know, a week to prepare, a week to recover when you come back because of the time zone shifts, you're talking, you know, probably a good month out of my year, but I could be coding and doing other things. So I have to think carefully about the international travel.
Yeah, that's a huge investment all the way around. But at least we usually hear from Bruce every time we go to Hamvention.
Yes.
Talks you guys up. So.
yeah. And Mel Witten's often, he does a great job evangelizing digital voice as well. He's at all the conferences. I think we've got a stand at Pacificon. Is it Pacificon coming up in about a month or so? So we'll be demonstrating the SM1000 there.
Do you guys have anything at scale?
Don't know.
I might have to see if any of the guys I know who go to scale can bring it out there, because it might be something that would be well suited to that conference.
I'll have to talk to the U.S. marketing department and see what's going on with that one.
Becoming a multinational, are we?
Yeah, I tend to put my head down. A lot of other guys go to the booths and stuff like that.
All right, well, do you want to talk up any of the developers or anything before we kind of wrap this up, or...?
No, I think I've mentioned all the ones that have had a key impact recently in the talk already. In particular, Rick Barnett is doing a fine job with being on the SM1000.
All right, sounds good. I'm looking forward to the release of the SM1000. I'll probably be on the bandwagon for buying one of those.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun developing, I must admit. Great to get the soldering iron out again and do some embedded stuff.
Yep, all right, cool. I don't think we had any more questions come out of the chat room. So, Pete, anything else before we get to the recipe corner here?
Nope, I've gone through my list. I'm good.
You had a list?
I did. Look, it's right here. I see.
Oh, excellent. Very cool. Well, thank you very much, Dave, for coming on the show again.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. Excellent. Fascinating. And I'm going to be following your blog and maybe making some comments.
Go for it. Yeah, very welcome. Okay, thanks, guys. See you later.
All right, thank you. That's Victor Kilo 5, Delta Romeo. Yeah, let's get that right. Delta Golf Romeo, Adelaide, South Australia. So thanks, Dave. That's great. I hope we get to talk to you again soon. If we don't see you at Hamvention, well, I'm sure we'll be in touch. So. And I think he may be gone already.
No, he hung up.
Oh, he hung up. All right. Well, that's too bad. Probably had things to do, stuff to code, C programs to make, SM1000s to build, you know, multinational corporations to take over, and
electric cars to build.
That's right, electric cars to manufacture. All right, well, with that, we're not going to do anything else except for talk about Cheryl's recipe for this month or week or fortnight. Yeah, fortnight. That's what it is. We do this.
Fortnight.
Yeah, something like that.
We're going to talk about your wieners.
Yeah, because you've already seen the ether pad. Yeah, actually,
thanks to Russ.
I went, was it last week? Yeah, it was last week we were supposed to do the podcast. I went in and got all, yeah, I like logged in at like 4 o'clock in the afternoon. There's nothing. And I was like, oh, cripes. Okay. And then it dawned on me, you know, because we were moving out of our house in Arkansas, that Russ didn't have any of his sound equipment there because it had already moved to the house in Missouri. I was like, oh, huh. Okay. So I already had everything in there. So, but anyway, I had actually posted this because of people, you know, having like Christmas parties and New Year's Eve parties and stuff. But since we've already zipped past all of that, the recipe that I am sharing this week is for brown sugar smokies. And we serve these a lot at our game nights that we have here at the house.
Game nights?
Yeah.
Game nights,
like
yeah.
Poker and board games.
Gay nights.
No, game nights. Well, they can be gay in the old sense, you know.
I've seen some pictures.
Yeah.
But carry on. Sorry.
All of our friends call this meat candy. And what it is it's cocktail. Yeah. No, and it literally is.
I'll leave that one alone.
Yeah. It's little smoky cocktail weenies, and you wrap bacon around them and roll them in brown sugar and broil them. Yep. Yes, they are very, very good. And then you can make a dipping sauce that's got mayonnaise and barbecue and brown sugar. So if you need a cavity by the time you're done, this is the thing to eat. We're having poker on Saturday night for my birthday, and half a dozen people went, are we doing the typical food? Because for Russ's birthday, we always have lobster rolls. And for my birthday, we either usually have Chinese food that we have to drive 40 miles each way to go get, or we have appetizers. And, you know, so as soon as they found out that, you know, yes, this is my birthday, they're like, oh, are we going to have any meat candy? Three different people asked me that. And I was like, yes.
So they're making you make it for your birthday?
Yes. Yeah. I also have, since I took a Wilton cake decorating class, I also have to make my own birthday cake.
Well, you're probably better off that way. You'll know it's good, you know.
True. Right. Yeah, Russ is still eating. I had a friend that had a Christmas party and had me make cupcakes for her. And Russ, there's some extra cupcakes, and we're still eating those cupcakes because they've been kept in the refrigerator, and they're still really good. So Russ and I had one for lunch today. So,
well, one thing I can say about the little smokies and the meat candy is you can describe the entire recipe in like 12 seconds, so we should probably just go ahead and do that. All you do is you take – we go to Sam's Club. We buy a 3-pound package of little smokies, and you get 2 pounds of bacon. 3 pounds of little smokies equals 2 pounds of bacon. You slice the bacon in thirds, raw, and then what you do is you wrap each smoky in a third of a slice of bacon, stick the toothpick through it, and then you take a whole handful of them as you make them and run them through a bowl full of brown sugar. And then you put them on a pan and you bake them for, I forget how long you bake them.
It's 10 excellent. Minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You bake them for 10 minutes until they like look awesome and taste good and smell good. And then you put them in a bowl and eat. And everybody loves these things. We don't have a single person who comes out here. Luckily, we don't have any kosher friends or anything like that, because that would be bad.
We can get kosher wieners, just ones that aren't made from pigs.
Well, I'm not sure. Well, yeah, I guess we could do turkey bacon and turkey wieners and all of that. But that would be cheating and stupid. So
kosher.
It would be kosher, yes. It would also be lame. So...
But, so now you're saying our Jewish friends are lame. Okay, great.
Do we have Jewish friends? I don't know that we do.
We do have Jewish friends.
We do?
They live in Washington, D.C.
Oh, yeah. Well, they're not coming here to eat smokies.
Yeah,
no.
They don't come here to eat smokies. Right. So.
All right. So anyway, that's that. So thank you.
You're welcome.
It's really weird to be talking to you and actually be able to see you.
Yeah, like across the table. I get to look at you and a dog. Yeah,
that's right. Who were mostly quiet this time, so... Anyway,
barking, but nothing too bad.
Yeah, we heard him a little bit ago, but it's all good now.
That's okay.
Yeah, I kicked him out of the room when they ran down the hallways.
So anyway, that's it. We talked with David Rowe, and we talked about candied wieners. So, I mean, that's a show right there. Indeed. And
start making some of these recipes to eat as we're talking.
You should.
Yeah. Well, maybe not as we're talking, but...
Yeah, you can fix these for next time and snack on them while we're doing the show.
Yeah, that's what you want. Usually I'm eating chips or chocolate bar, and Russ is like, what are you eating again?
Yeah, well, tonight we were, you know, time severely got away from me because I'm used to being here alone and doing the same thing, eating my bowl of cereal or whatever while we're doing the podcast. And at like 6 o'clock, I looked at the clock and went, oh, crap, Russ is here now. I've got to get dinner fixed. So, yeah, dinner came off the stove at 7:45. So we sucked down dinner super quick and ran back to the computers.
Yeah, I think we'll have this all worked out in 14 days' time when we do it all again. And there shouldn't be any more pauses in between shows. It was just a madhouse over the last 3 weeks or so, moving out of the other house and trying to find all the equipment and get everything set up again. But hopefully we're all done with that and we're back to normal. So I don't have any outro music, so I'm going to have to do all of that in post. So I guess we're just going to say the show's over.
All right.
And I'll do the rest of it afterwards. And
a good one it was. First it of was. 2015.
Yep. First
start of off with a bang.
Yep. And good to hear from you again, Pete. It's been a while.
Yeah. My computer blew up and I couldn't find another one. By the time I did, my connection was shoddy and then I couldn't get Skype to log in and I mucked around with it for I don't know how long until I realized, oh, I'm an idiot. I just need to update. And did that and, you know, it was working, which would have, you know, if I'd have just thought of it in the first place. Because I found a laptop that had a really old version of Skype on it. And I guess I'm not sure what the problem was, but it just wasn't connecting. I'm guessing the configurations for the ports were wrong, but I mean, I haven't researched it. It's working now, so that's all I care about.
All right.
So yeah, that was my my biggest problem. I lost the PC. The death of the PC. Sad.
Oh, well. We have that happen occasionally around here.
It was just a hard drive, actually, so I could replace the hard drive, but it's not really. I might. I don't know. I'm not sure what I'm going to do with it. It's still sitting in the corner. I don't throw away any computers usually.
Everything should be back to some sort of normalcy or whatever the new normal is by next time. So
the new normal.
Yeah, the new normal. All right. So with that, I guess we're done. And for those of you who are listening after the fact, you will be hearing intro now, or you'll be hearing outro rather at this point. And the rest of us will have long since gone to bed. So
that's right.
All right. So thanks everybody who's in the chat room and who's listening live. We appreciate it, and we'll catch you all in 2 weeks' time to do it all over again. See you then.